Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. In a world with 8.1 billion people and technology that can keep us connected to most of them, why are so many of us feeling lonely? In May of last year, the Surgeon General raised the alarm about the epidemic of loneliness and isolation, saying, quote, "Our epidemic of loneliness and isolation has been an unappreciated public health crisis that has harmed individual and societal health. Our relationships are a source of healing and well-being hiding in plain sight. One that can help us live healthier, more fulfilled, and more productive lives." Today, our topic is loneliness, why we're seeing more people feeling isolated, and what we can do to create meaningful relationships with one another. Joining us is Dr. Michael Bahari. He's retired pediatrician and healthcare consultant, former Neighborhood Falmouth Board president, and the Aging in Place columnist for the Enterprise newspapers. Hi, Michael.
Morning.
And Reverend Nell Fields from the Coit Congregational Church. Hi, Nell.
Good morning.
All right, so loneliness can be described in different ways because it's a feeling, right, an emotion. So now right. When you're interacting with members of your congregation or in the larger community, what are some of the signs that someone might be feeling lonely?
Oh, gosh, it really varies from person to person, but really it's a perceived sense of isolation. So we typically interact with people who are feeling lonely, typically in their own house. A lot of people who feel lonely aren't even getting out. But we pay special attention to people who have experienced a loss, going through grief. Maybe they've changed living situations. They've changed jobs. Or if they're feeling anxious, any one of those can be triggers for people. And the most important thing there is to acknowledge that and then start asking them, you know, how much time are you spending with your friends? How many times are you connecting with your family?
Mm-hmm. Mike, want to add anything to that?
The most common symptom is depression.
I was going to say, and they're different.
Very different. And the depression, you know, anxiety, not sleeping, not taking care of your body and your hygiene, you know, all the things you'd expect with someone who's depressed. Yeah.
During COVID, isolation was a serious issue, particularly for people who were living alone. Talk about the immediate and long-term impacts of COVID on loneliness and isolation, either one of you.
Well, I do want to say that loneliness existed
before that.
Correct. I think it took us a long time to sort of get out of that COVID mentality. You get so used to not connecting with people, and then, you know, we're still living with COVID, but when the worst was over, it took a while. It's still taking us a while to learn how to reconnect, how to reach out to people, how to be active, you know, get back into the routine of doing the things that help us to be healthy.
Yeah. During the pandemic, much of our social interaction moved to online, right? Social media, Zoom. Research shows that no matter our age, more time we spend on social media is associated with higher levels of loneliness, which makes sense if you're spending all your time there in these kind of fantasy worlds, right? But on the other hand, there are some benefits, right? And I'm thinking, Michael, of your Zoom with Neighborhood Falmouth. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, correct. When the pandemic started, Neighborhood Falmouth wanted to find a way to address, you know, isolation in our members who are an average age of 85. So we started a daily Zoom call, which we thought would be great. It turned out that most of the people who came on were not members because at their age, they didn't know how to use Zoom. So we found it was volunteers, it was staff, a lot of board members. But what happened over time, a core of about 12 to 15 people stayed on the Zoom, which was daily. And then we cut it down to 3 days a week and then 2 days a week. And now we're more than 4 years since we started. And there's still a core of 12 people
still doing it.
Still doing it, and who have become very, very close friends.
Yeah.
When we started, I knew who the people were, And when we finished, I mean, literally one couple became our closest friends here.
Yeah. So in that respect, I mean, for Zoom, yep. for some older people who can't maybe get out as
Absolutely.
Much, Zoom can be very beneficial.
Correct.
There's also a seasonal aspect to loneliness. In our region, there's a lot going on in the spring, summer, and fall, and plenty of ways to connect with people. But in the winter, we can feel more isolated. Right. Do you see seasonality playing a role?
Oh, yes. I think so. Our winters on the Cape, it plays a role for all of us. Mm-hmm. It's tougher to get out, you know, during those winter months. And, you know, there's not a lot of sun and it starts getting dark. And so it just sort of piles on that isolation and that feeling of loneliness. I'm a big advocate of faith communities because faith communities have a unique way of, you know, sort of built-in way to reach out to people. So we're always saying to our members, you know, check on each other, check on the elders, especially during the winter.
Mm-hmm. Michael, one of the things we think about loneliness, we think about being alone, but it isn't. You can be with people
and
have a family
Absolutely.
And still be lonely.
Correct. That there's a difference between social isolation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. There's certainly some overlap. And one of the causes of, you know, loneliness is social isolation. But there are people who are not isolated, who do feel lonely, and I can personalize that. I'm generally not lonely, but the bigger the crowd I'm in, I feel I'm not seen. And my wife has to drag me to galas and things like that. But I go to them, and the bigger it is, the more lonely I feel.
I think that makes sense, actually.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, for me, a definition of hell would be an eternal cocktail party.
And now, sometimes it might not be obvious, right. you know, that we're feeling, what we're feeling is loneliness. UCLA developed a loneliness scale, which asks individuals about a range of feelings, including how they feel the lack of companionship, they feel right. actually left out, they feel in tune with people around them, do they feel outgoing and friendly, do they feel there are people they can turn to? These are interesting questions that we can ask ourselves, right? Even if we're feeling okay, because it asks us to think more deeply about how we connect with others.
Right. And it's great that you mentioned that scale, because one of the things that Neighborhood Falmouth is going to do, we are planning to do a survey of people here in Falmouth, particularly seniors in Falmouth.
Yeah, and 60 use, plus.
And use that loneliness scale so we can start getting our hands around this issue. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people really are going to be affected by that. You want to talk about that, Mike?
Yeah, we actually applied to the town for a grant, which we should hear about in a couple of weeks. What we're planning on doing is the UCLA scale has 20-some-odd questions, but they've created a three-question valid survey, which we are planning to put on cards that will be every place in Falmouth that older adults congregate. And then we'll analyze those results to determine how serious a problem it is here in Falmouth. And we'll look at where people fill it out. So we expect that if you're filling it out at the senior center or somewhere else, that there probably may be a difference. Mm, you yeah. know, if you've gotten your act together to get to the senior center, you may not be as lonely as other people.
Yeah.
So,
we're going to head to Chatham. Leah LaCrosse is Director of Community Services for the town of Chatham. Hi, Leah.
Hi, good morning.
So, Leah, tell us more about this program, Chatham Better Together.
Oh, I would love to. We started to see here at the Chatham Center for Active Living, we started to see more people coming in who were reporting that they were extremely lonely, that they had been recently widowed or that their children were far away and they didn't have any friends. So through a grant with them by the Massachusetts Council on Aging in the amount of a small grant, it was $10,000, we began the Chatham Better Together program, and we did that to combat the loneliness and isolation in our older adults who lived alone in town. And we brought them together once a month for a year, for 3 hours every month, and we spent the first couple of hours doing enrichment activities or going on a field trip. And then we had a great lunch together. We were often joined by department officials within the town who would sit and talk to them, and right away this group bonded beyond our expectations. Mm. It was wonderful.
I was going to ask you, how long did it take before you started seeing relationships form within the group?
It was, miraculously, it was instantaneously. On the first day of the program, I did a series of icebreakers so that they could get to know each other. And we had a couple of members who, like gentlemen who realized they lived two houses down from each other. We had another two people who realized that they raised their kids in the same, on the same street in New Jersey, and their kids were friends. Mm-hmm. And everybody was laughing. They bonded instantly. And a year later, they are doing things together on their own. They attend programs together. The biggest thing that I saw was we had some people in the group who were recently widowed and they could barely talk about it. And now they're doing volunteer work. And it was just amazing. The results were amazing.
How did you find participants?
We actually, for this cohort, we actually handpicked them because we knew who was suffering a lot. Mm-hmm. And then as word got out, we had people call and ask to join. We didn't turn anyone away. And we even had a physician write a prescription to it for one of their clients, their patients, to attend our program. Mm-hmm. And we still have people asking to join. And so even past the grant year, we're going to continue the program. We find it critical to continue.
Now, you mentioned you got the $10,000. I imagine that that's probably been spent by now. So what is the cost of the program and how are you funding it?
So the cost of the program is about $10,000 a year between lunches and field trips. We're hoping for donations. We've been very humbled that we have some so far, some generous donors, and we're hoping to run it by donations and keep the momentum going. Mm. There's been studies showing that loneliness can increase the risk of mortality by 50%, which is higher than the effects of obesity and excessive alcohol use. Yep. So we find that this is very critical to continue.
Yeah. And what are you hearing from participants about the program?
That's the best part. we've had several of them, even writing to the press to say that the program has changed their lives. And that to me is the best thing of all they don't feel that despair anymore, and they don't feel like they have no one, and they're actively involved in activities now, and they're meeting each other for coffee outside of the programs here. And to me, that's the best outcome we could hope for.
So what advice do you have for other towns or community groups interested in running a similar program?
Just start it. I mean, this program is as simple as can be. It's bringing people together just once a month and letting them talk and letting, asking them things that they want to do. We went on a whale watch. We went to Heritage Gardens. We toured the police department, and those things thrilled them to no end. And to just begin and find the funding later if you have to, mm-hmm. but just begin it because it's so needed, I think, in every community on the Cape.
Yeah. So just do it, right?
Just do it. That's exactly right.
Leah LaCrosse is Director of Community Services for the town of Chatham. Leah, thank you so much for sharing your info with us. Hopefully some other groups can take some pointers from you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mindy. It's an honor.
We are talking about loneliness this hour. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about loneliness this hour, why we're seeing more people feeling isolated, and what we can do to create meaningful relationships with one another. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Dr. Michael Bahari, retired pediatrician and healthcare consultant, former Neighborhood Falmouth Board president, and the Aging in Place columnist for the Enterprise newspapers. Also with us, Reverend Nell Fields from the Wacoit Congregational Church. And joining us, Janelle Burley Hoffman, a consultant specializing on the topics of technology, health, and families. She's the author of the book, I Rules, What Every Tech Health Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Gaming, and Growing Up. She also runs the Crisis Line for Samaritans of Cape Cod and the Islands. Janelle, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you, Mindy.
So on a previous program with Stephanie Kelly, the director of Samaritans, she mentioned that many of the calls to the Crisis Line are from people who are isolated and lonely.
Absolutely. That's what we see. So we take about 10,000 calls a month through the rooted numbers of our two local lines, as well as being a location for the National 988 Crisis Line. And a large percentage of those calls that are coming through are people just looking for connection, looking to share a story, looking for to prevent loneliness or to share in their experience. And we see that as suicide and crisis prevention as being a place 24/7, 365 that people both local to the Cape and Islands and also nationally can reach out and connect with someone and be available to chat and share and prevent some of those experiences of isolation.
So you continue these conversations, right? You they're just lonely. You don't hang up on them. You keep talking.
Absolutely. You don't have to be in crisis to call. It's available to anyone. And we have crisis trained call line associates who pick up. They're both paid employees, volunteers, interns who are trained in working with people who are having emotional distress, who might need some additional support, or who just want that connection and conversation.
So how are the Crisis Line volunteers trained for people who are calling because of loneliness?
Sure. So there's, again, it's not just volunteers now, ever since we've become one of the rooting systems for 988, the national line, but everyone gets the same training. So they go through a localized Cape Samaritans-based training to keep that kind of hometown nonprofit warm feel. But they also go through the 988 Department of Public Health. It's called Vibrant Emotional Training. And they go through dozens of hours of coursework and training to be able to support the callers that come through, to be able to assess for suicide risk, imminent danger, imminent risk, things like that. But also to be able to have that conversation to de-escalate, to be a point of connection, to help people build safety plans, and to really see what they might need for their mental health in actionable items, but also that point where we know that there's always going to be someone there to answer the call, even if it's not the same call line associate at Samaritans, that there's always someone who will answer for them.
So then are you able to connect them with supports or services to help them connect with others beyond the crisis line?
Sure, absolutely. So we have dozens of resources supported by 988 Department of Public Health, both local and at the state level, and then certainly at the national level beyond what we offer. We don't give advice, but we befriend, right? So we do a lot of listening, but should they need additional resources, we absolutely have vetted resources and directions we can point them. And so in that way, it can be a warm line as well, right? Looking for answers to some questions and providing that support for them.
Do you get a lot of repeat callers?
We do. We have some frequent callers. We have some familiar callers, and then we get brand new callers. I mean, every day is a great adventure. You never know who's going to be calling in, but certainly there are people who see it as part of their daily rounds, if not weekly rounds, to make a call to 988 or the Cape Samaritans local line.
I would imagine, especially if you're somebody who's taking a call, you wonder, what happened to Mary? Why hasn't she called recently, right? Because you're like their friend.
Absolutely. So it is, you do befriend and you do care and concern. And a big part of the training is that we don't always know what happens to someone that we've talked with, right? Mm-hmm. We could have this very intimate, very meaningful moment and we don't know what happens next, but we always wish them the best, right? We always know that we've given them the tools that they might need in that moment. And we've shared that moment of human connection, which was such a big part of the segment previous to this with all of your guests, really talking about whether it's by a phone call or whether it's on the crisis line, that that moment of connection can be the thing that makes a difference in a person's life.
Yeah. Janet's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I'm an elder, and I do get lonely. My husband died years ago, and the worst part of getting old is losing your friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
They die, and you still have some friends, but most of them are in some sort of illness situation. But I did reach out to the Samaritans, and they have a program where they assign a person that you talk to once a week. And it's been really great.
Janet, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, that's so true. I mean, I think Janet's maybe a little bit older than I am, but you do. You get to a certain age where you start seeing your parents die, you know, your other relatives.
Gone.
And, you know, I can remember my grandmother lived to, like, she was 94. And, you know, she had had this best friend since she was in her 20s. And when she died, that was like such, and she had children who died before her. That can be really difficult. And so, Janelle, tell us about this program that Janet's talking about.
Sure. So the Samaritans, of course, is the crisis line is we're constantly offering different programs for the community based on community need. So over the years, there have been, you know, care packages sent to loss survivors. There's been opportunities to connect with people in the community in that kind of mentor befriending role. There's been community outreach, like we have a whole team running in the Falmouth Road Race coming up in a couple of weeks as an opportunity. So if anyone's at the Falmouth Road Race, feel free to cheer on those Samaritan runners. And then we have grief groups that we've run. So these things come in and out of the calendar based on funding, based on staffing, and based on our volunteer components. But of course, that crisis line is 24/7, 365.
And I know, Michael, no, you both see this a lot when folks are losing their friends, their spouse. It's a tough time. And I think we also have that loneliness when somebody isn't dying, but you've got children and they move away and you've got that empty nest thing. And what do I do now? Because your whole identity's right. been involved in raising this family, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I can connect with the woman in Martha's Vineyard. I'm in my 80s, and I've lost all of my siblings. And my closest friend here died about 2 months ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And my next closest friend is in hospice. Mm. So I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah.
And that really is probably one of the major causes of loneliness in older adults.
Yeah. Now you see that too?
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, it's change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And life is all about change. We're realizing now we're not very good about talking about it. And I think that as we grow older, it's very important for us to connect with people who are different generations. And one of the things that we're doing at Neighborhood Falmouth is a program where we are going to have high school students interview seniors so they each can share their stories.
Mm.
The most important thing, we keep saying the word connection. It is about connecting. It's
great.
Connecting one another. It's connecting across generations. It's not a difficult thing to do, but we have to be intentional about it. I think the other thing that we absolutely need to do is to build public awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope to do some ads, for an example, in the Falmouth Enterprise or the local newspapers that get people to start talking about this.
You brought up a good point about talking about it. Janet said that her once a month or once a week
Correct.
Conversations with Samaritans, mm-hmm. it makes her feel better, right? She's able to talk mm-hmm. about it. So, yeah. All right, Janelle, we're going to ask you to put on the consulting hat now. Adolescence can be a precarious and lonely time. We're trying to find out where we fit in the community. We're trying different things, sometimes failing, oftentimes struggling. It can feel isolating and lonely. And that's before smartphones and social media arrived. Talk about how smartphones have exacerbated and heightened teens' feelings of isolation and loneliness, despite being so connected.
Yeah, so of course, we're seeing a lot of research and books and kind of public commentary coming out about the impacts of social media, especially in 2024. We've seen a lot of studies reveal, and there's, you know, some concern about some of this, because what I know from my work directly with teenagers, right, outside of my work with Samaritans, I also work in communities and schools and work directly with families through that digital health and well-being and mental health component for families. And so when I talk to teenagers and when I'm actually curious about their experiences online, what I can see is that social media, social technology helps them to stay engaged, right? So I think there's this kind of, sometimes there can be this moral panic around the impacts of social media and social technology because it's new and because it's scary and because so many of us have not had that experience of growing up with it. But when we do actually talk to teenagers and young adults, they can talk about how they build agency. They learn about the world. They feel less isolated. So it's an and conversation, right? It depends on the experience of the user. It depends on the mental health of the community, of the family system. And so when we enter into this conversation, I think it's really important to remember not to villainize the technology, because we see it as an accessible, democratizing tool for a lot of young people who might not have had that connection. Mm-hmm. And that can simply be the teenagers that I've worked with who have built a lot of self-esteem by being excellent at a collaborative video game. Right? Maybe playing with peers outside of their own school or community, right? And they're really good at it. And they kind of get all this positive attention for being good at it. Or a young child who might feel isolated about sexual or gender identity, and they find a community online that affirms them, right? So there can be these ways that internet and technology can support mental health. And we want to kind of train our teenagers, talk to our teenagers about ways that they can strengthen their own digital mindfulness. Right? What are you feeling as you scroll through social media? Right? What feelings might come up for you? That we can curate our experience. We can kind of curate our algorithm to follow certain accounts, follow certain, whether it's influencers or YouTubers, that uplift us, that make us feel aligned with their morals and values or interests of things that they're talking about. And we can actually improve our experiences online by kind of paying attention to some of those feelings that come up for us and assessing, like, what's making me feel good, what's adding to my life, or what's making me feel insecure, or what's taking away from my life. And it's another tool that I love that I've learned from teenagers and young adults is how they are setting some time limits and parameters and even putting parental controls on their own devices so that they can have their time to just kind of scroll for no reason and then get up and finish their homework or their assignments or be to work on time. So it's interesting to kind of follow the lead of young people to see the ways in which they're supporting the health and well-being of their own digital lives so they can have that and conversation, right? It can improve their life and not take away from it.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of this comes down to age appropriateness too, right? You don't want to give a younger child access to the world like that. So, and I think it's tough for those of us who didn't grow up with, the kids are way better at it than we are, right? And so, and I think as you're mentioning, talking about it and finding out, because sometimes you look at, let's say, Facebook, for example, and you see what, look at these great lives people are having. They're doing all this fun stuff and I don't have any of this. And it's not reality. Nobody's posting up there the bad days. They're posting the good days and sometimes totally exaggerating those good days, right?
Yeah, and I think that conversation, it's like everything we've talked about here today. It's as Mr. Rogers says, if it's mentionable, it's manageable, right? If we can talk about these things, if we can bring them out into the open. And so a lot of teenagers, they understand that a lot of what they're seeing is being Photoshopped, that a lot of what they're seeing is people's highlight reels, very curated content. And so they're very aware of that. So sometimes, again, that's part of the mindfulness conversation and asking them to remind themselves, like, even if we're using media criticism and media literacy, especially during an election cycle, right? Asking them to have both that formal learning that might happen inside school or inside their homes about how do we know if something's real and true? And then also having it in that informal learning about conversations between peers, conversations with parents and family. So some of this is really intentional. And a lot of this, the kids are thinking about much more than we ever give them credit for. Mm-hmm. But I think to your point is thinking about it like we would think about any other aspect of our children's lives. Like, is this healthy and appropriate for who my child is at this moment in time? Right. And are we talking about it? Are we guiding? Do we have appropriate expectations, boundaries, parameters to support that full whole child? And support their interest and curiosity and the fun that technology can be.
Yeah. So I guess what's your messaging then for parents? I mean, you can't all of a sudden start as a teenager, right? I mean, you've got to start these conversations earlier. And that's always a tricky question is when and how you introduce kids to that, to the digital world.
Yeah, I love this. And we could stay, Mindy, forever and ever and talk about this conversation, but I believe deeply in scaffolding, right? So looking at what's child and adolescent development, some great resources out there are to get to know internet technology, to get to know the age ratings is places like Common Sense Media, which is a free national nonprofit that helps to vet different games, apps, platforms. It's a great first stop. There's the Family Online Safety Institute, another national nonprofit that does incredible parent education. They have a whole good digital parenting section. So I encourage parents to engage with the education and resources that are out there and also start talking about tech. Start talking about your own tech use, right? Our kids are certainly, even if they don't have their own phones or they don't have their own devices, they're certainly seeing us use our devices. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely going to be a part of their lives. There is no going back to a world without the internet and technology.
Right.
So the sooner we integrate our tech use into family and culture, we give our kids opportunities to formally learn, informally learn, practice with some boundaries and some guidance. That's where we're seeing kids have the best experiences with life online, not the perfect experiences, right? But the healthiest experiences. And that's what we want to build our lives towards, is that integration of the healthiest possible use of technology and using it for all the incredible aspects it brings to our lives and to our families and to our community.
We know that kids like adults who are engaged in face-to-face interactions, like mm-hmm. be it sports, clubs, are typically healthier and happier, right? But taking that first step, putting yourself out there to engage can be hard, right? And it seems like there are, you know, some kids maybe spend a lot of their time on, you know, texting and social media, don't seem to always have the best skills when it comes to face-to-face kinds of conversations. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I think from the parenting lens, right, we want to encourage our kids to make connections. So those connections don't mean they have to be the star of the team. It doesn't mean they need, you know, 20 best friends. It can be small, meaningful connections to build belonging, to build esteem, right? That's what we're looking to do. We're not looking to have our children be the top of the class, the top of the sports team, the star of every show. We're really looking for simple. A big part of today's conversation was also simple, right? What is the simplest act? What is taking that first step? What is inviting a friend over to play? What is meeting another family at the playground, right? When our children are very young, to help model and practice those social skills, right? What is, how do we build in, how do we be a guest? How do we host? How do we offer someone a juice box, right? All of these skills our kids need to be taught so that they're practiced and they're versed when they start to grow into adolescence and a little more independent with those social skills and life away from their kind of family and home life. So again, like we talked about using the screens and technology in a scaffolded way, we need to help our kids build their social skills in a scaffolded way. And I think parents can be great guides during the younger years for that, and that it's okay to feel nervous, right? Validating our children. We've never done this before. It's hard to be a beginner, right? And using a lot of terms like that, like, I'm right here, let's just give it a try, right? A lot of affirming and validating those feelings and then encouraging them if it doesn't go their way. That is part of human development. We all make mistakes. We are not all good at everything, but I think building confidence through putting ourselves out there trying something new, we build up that agency and tolerance for discomfort. And I think that overcoming challenges can also build confidence and esteem in a child.
Janelle Burley-Hoffman's consulting, specializing on the topics of technology, health, and family. She's the author of the book, Eye Rules, What Every Tech Health Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Gaming, and Growing Up. And she also runs the Crisis Line for Samaritans of Cape Cod and the Islands. Janelle, as always, thanks for being with us. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Thank you for letting me wear all my hats today.
You bet. You bet. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about loneliness this morning and what we can do to create meaningful relationships with one another. With us is Dr. Michael Bahari, retired pediatrician and healthcare consultant, former Neighborhood Falmouth board president, and the Aging in Place columnist for the Enterprise newspapers, and Reverend Nell Fields from Aquoit Congregational Church. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talked about loneliness can happen even when we interact with friends and family. Let's talk a little bit about the quality of our relationships, because it's not quantity, right? It's quality.
Correct. You can have dozens of people you know but the quality is not there, the time is not there. I think it's important that you be around people who make you feel that you're worthwhile, mm-hmm. that you have a purpose. People who listen to you are not judgmental. I think that's very important. And I think you're better off having 2, 3, 4 people like that in your life, you know, rather than 30 or 40, you know, acquaintances, you know, that you go to parties with. So.
Right. That tell you what you should and shouldn't do.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And now I think that's an important point that Michael just brought up, which is non-judgmental.
Right, yeah. Right.
Who do you don't want to tell somebody something if they're going to judge you?
Right. And these days, you know, you feel like you've got to watch where you step or what you say. But also related to what Mike said, there's certain groups in our society that don't necessarily feel safe with other folks. So, for an example, loneliness is a big issue with elders who identify as being part of the LGBTQ community. When you're out in society and you see people that don't look like you or don't share the same things that you do, it is very isolating. Mm-hmm. The town did something extraordinary. The town of Falmouth did something extraordinary this year. They had a pride event at the Gus Canty Center. For the LGBTQ community, I've never seen so many people in one room. It was so wonderful that people could be there, be themselves, celebrate who they are. And that's tough to do if you're an elder and you're living alone, and if you identify as gay. You know, how do you make those connections? So I think we have to be intentional about doing that. And it addresses in a bigger way that sense of belonging. I have a good friend of mine who is a person of color, and she said, Nell, I feel lonely walking downtown Falmouth.
Right.
Because there's not people who look like her.
Look like her, yeah. I think, and that's true for, I think, most marginalized communities, but especially, I think, for the LGBTQ community, it's scary because it might not just be the reaction. It can be dangerous, right? You just, you know, you don't know. And sometimes we feel that people don't know the real me. But
right,
showing
right.
our true selves can
right.
also make us vulnerable to
right.
rejection.
Right.
So do we need to be willing to face some kind of rejection to make meaningful connections?
Well, I think what's interesting, and I have found personally, is that the more I share, the better the connection and feedback is. Mm-hmm. If you read my articles, I always try in every one of them to share something personal about myself. My wife will read the article and say, why are you telling people that?
Yeah.
And I have found the more I do that, the better the feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. Because people can relate. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cindy's giving us a call from Worcester. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for this topic.
Sure.
Yeah, loneliness. And especially with COVID, you know, just feeling very isolated. But thankfully, I'm in a 12-step program, so I had Zoom, and now I'm in in-person meetings. But I often wondered, and I'm just wondering if there's such a thing as a program that connects young adolescent teenagers with elderly people that live alone and possibly just, you know, visit them and read to them or whatever. Is there a program like that happening? Because I often thought that would be a good thing.
Yeah. Well, it depends on where you live. Here in Falmouth, we have something called VIPS, which connects volunteers, mostly elderly, with students as mentors and as teachers. There's also a lot going on online. There's a new program called Elder A, and you go online, and they vet you, and they vet students around the country, and they connect you up. And apparently it's been wonderful for the families and wonderful for the older adult.
Yeah. Cindy, that's such a good point that you bring up. And just thinking, and you don't, I mean, it's great to have the programs, but I'm just thinking, you know, as everybody knows, I have a 9-year-old grandson that we're raising, and I have a neighbor who's in her 80s who occasionally will babysit for him, right? And I talked about, there was some new neighbors who had some teenage girls, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if they're babysitting age. And her response was, don't you take him away from me.
Right.
She, you know, that interaction, you know, it's good for both the younger kids and this, you know, the seniors who are caring for
them. It gives the younger people a purpose and to care about someone else. And sometimes when they're having their own mental problems, it can be really helpful to be there and help someone else. Yeah. I just think it... So it's wonderful. I just wanted to ask, the Falmouth program is called ZIPES?
It's VIPS, Volunteers in Public Schools. Yeah. But okay. Cindy, thanks for the phone call. As a predicate of premature death, insufficient social connection is a bigger risk factor than, I think we had somebody mention this earlier, than obesity and the equivalent of smoking up to 15 cigarettes
Correct.
A day. Who knew? And this is according to Julianne Holt Lundstedt. She's a psychology professor at Brigham Young University and one of the leading figures in loneliness research. She also says loneliness is strongly correlated with cognitive decline and dementia.
Absolutely.
So we as individual community, we need to pay attention to this.
Well, and I think it's about being intentional and just that, what you just read, people don't know that.
Right.
We're not very good about getting the word out, but we really need to. As a wider community, we have to start talking about this. We have to start reading more articles in the newspaper. We need to talk about this on a governmental level. There, you know, maybe there's some sort of stigma attached to the word loneliness, but it is impacting all of us.
Yeah. Correct. And there are probably people who might be a little bit shy or, you know, feel awkward in new social situations or, as Mike was saying, in the you know, big crowd. What are some ways to help them feel more comfortable? And I think that's the rest of us who might notice that, right? And
Correct.
Start a conversation. I mean, what do we do to help?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes a community a village is people reaching out to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a neighbor who seems alone, who seems distressed, you know, go talk to them. I think all of us need to be kind. You know, talking to someone while you're waiting online to get into a restaurant. I mean, just things like that.
It is amazing you say that. Not even talking, just smiling at a stranger,
right?
Can change their whole day around.
Absolutely.
Make eye contact. Yeah. When I'm out grocery shopping, I make sure I make eye contact with people.
Right.
And if you're aware, you can spot the people who need a smile, that need to be uplifted. The other thing I would suggest, yes, reach out to your neighbors, reach out to folks who are alone. They may not be lonely. But then offer to do something with them. Do they need a ride to volunteer somewhere? Mm-hmm. Do they need a ride to a faith community? Do they need a ride to senior center? Because part of this issue, too, is it's one thing.
Access.
How do we get out? Yeah.
Access.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very tough. And you mentioned volunteering. That's a connecting with people around a common interest or goal is a great way, right, to make meaningful relationships. And when you think of all the volunteering opportunities,
look
how many nonprofits we have,
right,
across the whole listening area.
Yeah.
There's whatever you might be interested in. I think one of the things, too, I hadn't thought about this until, as actually many remember Diane Rehm and her husband John, when he was preparing to retire, he planned the whole thing out. I mean, he thought about, right, what am I going to do? What's going to be my purpose? And I thought, wow, people, I had never thought of that.
Right.
But that's a big moment in people's lives when they retire. And then it's like, oh, what am I going to do?
Correct. I mean, I think, interestingly, the number one thing, if you go on the internet and look up how to take care of loneliness, the number one thing, volunteer, volunteer, volunteer.
Yeah.
And it really makes a tremendous difference. And there's a number of studies that show that older adults who volunteer are healthier. And it sort of dampens some of what, you know, we know are the downsides of loneliness.
Yes. And to that point, Mindy, Mike and I have been talking about how what kind of programs can we develop or do. And one of the things we're looking at, can we do a telephone program where seniors, elders who are homebound, can pick up the phone and call maybe another senior or make a phone call in some related way, so that even people who can't get out, can we give them an opportunity for meaning making, you know, to volunteer.
Right. Yeah. Also, I'm just thinking back to the volunteer opportunities where we mentioned, you know, retired, but younger people too. I mean, yes. When you think about those, and there you get that interconnection between generations where, you know, we can learn a lot from each other, right? Just listening. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. And there's, like I said, many, many, many different organizations you can volunteer for. Now, and it can be challenging to make connections, as you're mentioning, now, when you are no longer driving or you have physical limitations, but not impossible. And neighborhood organizations like Neighborhood Falmouth, and there are other organizations like that. For folks who aren't familiar, Michael, tell listeners what Neighborhood Falmouth is.
Neighborhood Falmouth is in its 15th year. And the organization, it's a membership organization. We have 125 members who are elderly. The average age is in their 80s. And using over 150 volunteers, we provide services that essentially is helping to, you know, improve community and connection. Probably about 65% of what we do is driving, is taking people to medical appointments, to, you know, shopping, to the senior center to get their hair cut. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have people whoever we take them to the salon. Mm-hmm. The other thing we do is we'll go in the home and help with technology. We'll do friendly visits. We'll go and play Scrabble with somebody. So it's really all about connection. And what we have found is that in doing that, our members connect with the volunteers. And all of our volunteers, or most of our volunteers, are also over 60. And the bonds that are created are really quite remarkable.
Yeah. And you mentioned it's members. Is there a cost involved? And if
yes.
You can't afford it, can yes. you still be a member?
Oh, absolutely. About 20% of our members cannot pay. And we have an assistance fund that's separate from our regular budget. So no one is turned away because of cost. The only reason we turn people away is we need a lot more volunteers.
Yeah, another opportunity to volunteer, right?
Absolutely.
And we should mention, all the folks who come in and they're vetted.
Absolutely.
You vet them so that you don't have to worry about, you know, them being
right. And in the 15 years we've been doing this, we've never had a single problem.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I think people don't think, we mentioned they help with technology. Our libraries do that too.
Yes.
Like, you know, you can, if you're still driving enabled, you can just walk into the library.
The library, and especially here in Falmouth, our libraries are terrific. And they do a great job helping people of any age with technology. But it's also a great place to connect with people in general. It's a, I guess, what do they call it, a third zone? Or, you know, it's definitely a community. The libraries now are becoming
community centers.
Community
Correct.
Centers,
they
indeed.
Absolutely are. Yep. Yeah,
indeed.
Absolutely. As you know, we've been going around doing some live broadcasts from the libraries. And I've been amazed it's worth going to these different towns and checking out these libraries. They
yes,
they all
terrific.
Are so unique
yeah.
and provide services that you would yeah. never dream you would yeah. find in a library. Okay, about 30 seconds left. Michael, I'll give you the last word.
Okay. I mean, if you're lonely here in Falmouth, I suggest this coming Friday, you read The Enterprise. My article is on loneliness strategies to stay connected.
And we can get that online.
Absolutely.
So if you can't get the paper here in Falmouth, if you're elsewhere,
you can get it online. And in that article, I outline about 7 or 8 things that you can do to stay connected.
All right. Dr. Michael Bahari, retired pediatrician, healthcare consultant, former Neighborhood Falmouth Board president, and the Aging in Place columnist for the Enterprise newspapers, and Reverend Nell Fields from the Raquoit Congregational Church. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. The
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.